About space, you know, and that's where I got in trouble. I said I was John Q from outer space. And I found out one thing, we must never land, you know, just one at a time. And I've seen a lot of saucer people, and but I can't talk about it, you know, because back in the zoo. So we just got to wait, you know, until 1985, and then, oh, yeah, freeze those cats in the street on the streetcars and everything else. But I can hold off. I've got a little magazine article, 1985, coming out there in the Popular Mechanics. You'll see it in the April issue, and it's all there. But I thought, there is a lot of talk about flying saucers. And I want you to meet a man this evening that's actually seen some 300 flying saucers. And your name, sir?
My name's Elwood P. Suggins, and I'm from Bellbrook, Ohio.
Mm-hmm. And you've seen some 300 flying saucers, is that right, sir?
Yes, that is very true.
When did you see your last flying saucer?
The last one I seen was here Sunday week. It was out in a wheat field.
In a wheat field. Isn't that a little unusual?
No, I think they must feed off wheat or something.
I see. Can you describe the saucer to us?
Oh, very easily. I've seen over 300 of them. It's about as big as this here room. And when it come down, it give off a real funny whirring sound. And the heat it give off was just intense. It was intense. Me and my kid was there, and it was fierce.
I see. And then what happened, Mr. Sutton?
Well, and this here door opened up, and this little ladder come down, and this here teeny man come down this here ladder.
Wait a minute, Mr. Suggins. When you say teeny, what do you mean by teeny?
Well, like I say, he come down this here ladder and crossed over the road and reached up and milked my cow like this. I'd call that teeny, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would, Mr. Suggins. Well, did he speak American? Did he speak English?
Yes, he did. He had this here glass head on him, and there's a little armature inside, and he went,
"Hello, I'm a Martian. I hope I speak your language. This is a recording."
And then what happened, Mr. Suggins?
Well, then I waited for the flip side.
"Take me to your leader. Take me to your leader."
And did you take him to your leader?
No, I didn't know who my leader was.
Well, boys and girls, is that how you feel? I didn't know who my leader was. You look around and say, who's my goddamn leader? Well, the date is November the 25th, the day after Gobble Gobble Day. I hope you all had a pleasant Thanksgiving. We had several emails come in here, and we thank you for those emails, and now we'll get on with the show. Yeah, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations, and we'll take it from there. Well, here in the dugout, here in the bunker, we don't swing right or left, but we will pick up things that we feel are the truth. And sometimes that's on the left, sometimes on the right, sometimes in the middle. But that's not our intention entirely. What is our intention is that whatever's good for the white race is good. Whatever's bad for the white race is bad. And we'll all agree that the white race, to survive, has to have clean water, has to have good, wholesome food, has to have a lot of things that aren't just basically talking race every day. So today, we're going to talk about the coal mining situation. And there's a lot of disagreement on that, but I think that, like in West Virginia, they're destroying the damn state with coal mining. I don't think there's much coal mining, coal down there to mine anymore. They've pretty well wiped West Virginia out. Anyhow, there's a new book out called Blood on the Mountain. I'm going to play an interview with the author.
Never been a diversification of the economy. And, you know, they feel stuck. They feel desperate. They feel angry. And on top of it, you know, again, you know, like Trump's propaganda, the propaganda of Friends of Coal, just like that, was propaganda meant to divide people against each other. On one side, there's jobs, and on the other side, there's everything else. And if you structure it that way and you propagandize the way Friends of Coal did and the way the Trump campaign did, this is what you get. And it's going to be really deeply concerning to see what happens when those coal miners realize that their jobs are not coming back. The coal industry chose to go bankrupt so they could take all of their money and not pay any of the billions in liabilities and damages to the environment, or the billions that they owe to the UMW retired coal miners, you know, and you couldn't make them go back to work if they have to.
Mm-hmm.
It's a capitalistic society.
Well, in that sense, the coal industry, as documented in your film, really reflects a lot of Donald Trump's industries.
Absolutely.
They go for as many profits as they can with no regard to the workers, and then when it's all done, you go bankrupt so you don't have to pay the pensions. Or in many cases, just change the name of the company. Patriot Energy is one of the creepiest parts of the film, when suddenly this brand new coal company comes to town, and it's actually the same company with a new name.
That's right. And, you know, Patriot was the test case to see if the United States bankruptcy courts would allow these coal companies to shed themselves off billions in pensions, promised pensions, health care and retirement benefits to the retired coal miners, and all the billions they owe to reclaim over 1 million acres of land that they leveled, hundreds of these impoundments of coal slurry, like at Buffalo Creek, but now they hold each one of them 8 to 10 billion gallons of slurry each.
Yeah, I don't mean to make it sound like the film's a drag, because it's a very important film, and I think every American needs to see it, especially if you're wondering how the Donald Trump election could happen. I mean, it's almost like y'all knew how incredibly timely this film was. But
yeah, how did you know he was going to win?
I did not know that.
One of the saddest scenes in the film for me is the scene at a protest when you see, at a demonstration, when you see coal workers having screaming fights with climate change activists, and they should both be on the same side, and they just don't realize it.
That's our argument as well, yeah. I mean, these are, again, the industry has been very successful in separating these two constituencies and making them feel as though they should be at odds, when we know that across the board they're, you know, they're responsible for these situations. And so that's one of the things that we think the film is really successful in doing, is that it, across the spectrum of social justice, it can speak to all of these different constituencies, bring them into dialogue in a way, and try to reverse, you know, the behavior of the industries.
Continually throughout the film, workers will say, when they would go in to complain about conditions, the mindset was, we got 1,000 guys out there who've put in applications who would love your job.
That's right.
And that's how, especially in a geographically remote location, the exploitation can go on and on for a century.
Sorry, John. And one other point I want to make up. Yes, that's how the exploitation goes on for centuries. But I do want to say this. West Virginia has been the first line of resistance. In 1921 at Blair Mountain, the Battle of Blair Mountain, from that came the United Mine Workers of America. Labor was born in America. The reason everyone has an 8-hour workday and our child labor laws and workers' comp is because the people of West Virginia rose up in 1921, laid down their lives. And, you know, we are concerned that where labor was born in America, we are not going to allow labor and unions to die in America.
So what's the good news?
The good news is that we're here today. The good news is that we are going to resist. The good news is we're all going to do the right thing for our brothers and sisters.
Well,
and
you sound like me the last 8 days on this radio show.
John, we got a lot in common.
The film, again, is called Blood on the Mountain, and it's so highly recommended. And it really is a great movie about labor, about the environmental movement, about the issue of coal that I would say, with one quote taken out of context in one Hillary Clinton speech, swung an entire state to a guy who is part of the problem. I'd like to remind our listeners what happened 6 years ago during the big blast at the Massey Upper Branch coal mine. For many of us, our only lingering memory is the incredible speech President Obama gave at the memorial service for the workers. What went down that day, and who didn't go to jail for that preventable disaster?
Oh, gee. Well, in my opinion, You know, Senator Joe Manchin talks about how Don Blankenship has blood on his hands, and since Governor Manchin was governor at that time, I would ask him who allowed him to get all that blood on his hands.
Fair enough. But how many men died that day?
29 men died that day. And
this isn't the 1800s. This is 2010.
This is April 5th, 2010. And actually, it's when Blood on the Mountain was born, because I was there. I was filming. And, you know, the sheer desperation of people down there, the hopelessness, the fear, it was just absolutely overwhelming. And, you know, after UBB, all the promises are always made that things are going to change. But nothing has changed in West Virginia. The mine safety laws have not been changed. Senator Manchin has not introduced or gotten any legislation changed that would make health and safety any different for those coal miners today than they were on April 5th, 2010, that day they went to their certain death in that coal mine deep in the hole at UBB.
And you're convinced it was preventable?
As God is my witness, it was absolutely preventable.
I'm convinced of that, too. Yeah. How significant was the Black Lung Benefits Act that was passed by Congress in 1972? Because I always thought that was a symbol of where they won one battle.
They did. My God, you can imagine, it's incredibly important. Some of the younger miners, I want to tell you, that died at UBB that day in their early 20s had black lung in their autopsy.
In their early 20s.
That's right, in their early 20s. But what has happened right now, what's going on with black lung benefits now, first of all, it was always hard to get them because the coal companies would always hire lawyers and, you know, make sure you did. Very few coal miners get black lung benefits.
Now, one that did, though, is Terry Steele, who is featured in the film. His father, actually, at the time that the Black Lung Benefits Act was passed, he was actually able to gain benefits from that act. He still died of black lung, as did his grandfather. But he was actually able to access those.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but what's happening now, you know, with Donald Trump being in and the Affordable Care Act and what's happening with these pensions and retirement benefits is that the very few people that do have black lung disability will lose that.
You appear in the film.
I do not appear in the film.
You don't appear in the film. Okay, I'm very sorry.
But I'm glad that you think I do.
Well, the whole film is about your passion for this area, and you are from this area. And I was wondering, in the making of the movie, did your subjects welcome you, or were some of them less trusting?
All the subjects in the film were very welcoming. They wanted to speak. And it's interesting, after the election, there's a lot of dialogue going on down there among coal miners and people they thought they hated that were environmentalists. Those discussions are starting to happen. And that's one of the things that was so important with this film, is the outreach for the film. And the fact that we do have the AFL-CIO of America, along with the Sierra Club and Earth Justice and, you know, 30-some other groups, all together in dialogue, doing outreach with this film. And I think that is an incredible testament to them and also to where we're moving forward, so that, you know, all workers understand, all people understand, we have so much more in common with each other.
Absolutely.
Than we do differently.
But your film shows to a devastating extent how both patriotism and a demonization of environmentalism can keep these people trapped at the back of the bus.
If you believe the propaganda.
If you watch this film and your drinking game word is tree huggers, you'll see what happens, because the industry, right down to the workers, refer to any environmentalist or any activist or demonstrator, they're all tree huggers or environmental extremists, words that are used to demonize and in turn shore up their own support and strength.
Well, yeah, and interestingly, you will note as well that Don Blankenship uses the same kind of language to describe unionized workers at the beginning of the
Union
film.
Terrorism,
union
I believe,
terrorism.
Is the expression he uses, yeah.
It's a potently effective tool.
Yeah, and again, the goal of one interviewee says is to extract as much as they can until they leave West Virginia a dead zone.
And they're close at this point.
Yeah.
You know, listen, if there was any coal to be mined down in West Virginia or Kentucky, those coal companies would be down there mining.
Right, exactly.
They don't need Donald Trump to tell them to go down there. If they could make a dollar, if they could get a pound more of flesh, they'd do it.
The use of patriotism to bring these workers to heel is chilling in the movie.
Yes, and, you know, I mean, this has happened throughout history.
Sure has.
It's
worker control.
That's right. It's people control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when people get desperate in economic situations and they look to a strong man to save them, you know, we're in a situation like that right now. And I think that's why it's so important, you know, to be talking about this.
Well, he will save them because he's going to give the rich people in their state a huge tax cut, and in turn, that'll trickle down to them. It's going to be a whole different kind of Republican governance.
Listen, man, it ain't raining. They're pissing on you from above. I mean, that's what that means when it comes to that.
Economic cave-in.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly right. It's such a pleasure to have you both. How can people see the film?
Well, the film will be in New York and Los Angeles for the next week, starting tomorrow, and then it will be in Washington, D.C., in December 9th to the 15th, and then we'll follow that. We'll have some more selected dates, and then we'll hopefully have a broader digital and DVD, hopefully broadcast release.
You know what?
Spring.
Let us know when it's going to be on pay-per-view, and we'll have you all back, even if it's just a phone call to promote even more.
And
it's a really
so
important movie, and again, there's no way you could have known how incredibly timely it would be the week it came out. If you want to understand how hardworking people could vote for a guy who's going to do nothing for them, this film explains it, and it's a great piece of filmmaking. My compliments to you both.
Thank you so very much. Really
Blood on the Mountain, folks. Put it in your queue and watch for it. We'll be right back.
I'll tell you, if you want to read some real kick-ass information, you read about those miners down in West Virginia back in the 20s and the Molly Maguires and the different groups of white guys, almost all white guys fighting for their rights against the big coal mine owners and so forth. I'll tell you, it's something else. And we got to be honest that most of the people that are into the big mining stuff and doing all this stuff in West Virginia are Republicans. The Democrats are in it too, but not as much as the Republicans, so remember that. Well, I'm going to do a little reading today again, and this time it's from that book, Cult of Equality, by Stuart Omer Landry. Now, this book was published, let's see, published back in 1945. And if white people had done what they ought to be doing, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in today. This is chapter 11. And it talks about Negro delinquencies and deficiencies. Negroes as a race exhibit many failings. This is particularly true of African Negroes. In the United States, their descendants still show the effects of heredity, and their standards in every way are low when compared to those of the white race. It must be realized that in the United States, the majority of the Negroes are not pure racially. There is considerably admixture of white blood, and many Negroes are from 3/4 to 7/8 white. This intermixture has had the effect of decreasing Negro characteristics, both physically and mentally, in those possessing so great a proportion of white blood. Also, many Negroes in the United States are educated and some possess wealth. Although this is a purely arbitrary estimate, I would say that from 5 to 10% of them do not exemplify the delinquencies I write about here. Many are just as moral and law-abiding as the better class of whites. Of course, with respect to certain qualities and proportions might be much larger. The first great failing of the Negro peoples is a moral one. It is the lack of character. This is brought about by their philosophy, by their traditions, and by racial characteristics such as extreme emotionalism and instability of temperament. They are inflicted with shiftlessness and sensuality, which is hereditary. I would also add to that I believe the mixed race Negro is the most undependable in the sense that the same holds true in the animal world. The mixed sometimes smarter, yeah, more, maybe more clever, but also less dependable and more apt to cause problems. You know, look at Malcolm X. He had red hair, and he was a mixed race, and Obama's mixed race, and all these mixed race Negroes, of course, can cause more trouble than the pure Negro. Negroes do not face difficulties or adversity with courage and determination. They slink away rather than meet the issue. If they want to quit a job, they do not have the courage to tell their employer that they're leaving. They take French leave and fail to show up again. In business transactions, they will sometimes dispute and argue over trivial differences, but they will more often accept the other party's point of view and go away inwardly dissatisfied. This occurs frequently in their dealings with white people. They will weaken if a white man is firm, but will protest loudly and vehemently if they think he is weak. You see that even on the street. You meet two or three Negroes coming down the street, and if you look down at the ground or move out of the way, they know you're weak and you're liable to get jumped. But if you look them right in the eye and walk straight ahead, they tend to let you alone. The pure African Negro exhibits many characteristics peculiar racially. Dr. Phillips, writing of the Negro in Africa, notices garrulous conversation and interspersed with boisterous laughter, lasting well nigh the livelong day. Of typical African Negroes, he affirms that impulsive and inconsistent, sociable and amorous, voluble, dilatory and negligent about robust, amiable, obedient and contented, they have been the world's premium slaves. They make good slaves. But the troubled Tommy says they may be good slaves, but they're very unproductive. Compared to, you compare Negro labor in the South to white labor in the South or the North, and you'll see the difference. This is a very good description of the Negro psychology that fits the cornfield Negro of the South today. J.E. Lind in the Psychoanalytical Review says that the American Negro corresponds to the African in anthropometric tests, precocity of children, failure to grasp subjective ideas, early puberty, and reversion to savagery. In addition to those mentioned by Dr. Phillips, the Negro has other traits that seem to be racial characteristics, such as the lack of sense of time, slothfulness, and inferior mentality. Sex morals. The Negro is notoriously loose in matters of sex. In this respect, the Negro is really unmoral rather than immoral, for the reason that he has never learned or accepted the standards set by the Anglo-Saxon peoples. John Dollard, in Caste and Class, admits that the low sexual standards of Negroes. Other sociological observers report the same condition, which is a matter of common knowledge to all Southerners. Slavery, of course, might have been one of the causes of the Negro prevalent immorality. On the other hand, slave owners often tried to bring Christianity to their slaves, and some not only permitted but urged them to marry. And under slavery, because of restrictions, the Negro could not run wild as he had been able to do since emancipation. After the Civil War, Southern Negroes practiced free love generally and paid little attention to legal marriage. although all states passed laws legalizing the unions formed during slavery, in many of the counties in the Black Belt today, most of the so-called marriages are temporary or common law marriages. The census report of 1904, Negroes in the United States, says unquestionably, many Negroes who have never been united in a marriage ceremony and many who after a legal marriage have separated and formed other and illegal unions regarded and reported themselves as married to those with whom they were cohabitating at the date of the census. The following statements, while by no means typical of conditions all over the South, are undoubtedly true of the large proportion of Negroes. Legal marriage is not considered absolutely necessary. Of 40 couples who reported themselves as married, only 20 were legally married in the church or by civil authorities. Numerous cases are seen of two persons legally married and yet living with a different person and reporting as being married to the second. This condition undoubtedly exists today, and the generalization holds true of the majority of Negroes, at least in the rural South. Negroes form unions without the benefit of clergy, but it must be said that they often regard these as marriages that they will fight anyone who tries to break into the arrangement. But they treat these matters lightly at other times and are continually changing partners. Thus, their family life is unstable and their children are scattered. This loose manner of living is one of the causes of the Negro's failure as a citizen. It is, of course, difficult to make any accurate statement about the immorality of Negroes, but that it still must be high, it is proven by the syphilitic rate. Syphilis is a disease of immorality and a high rate of illegitimacy. In a recent study of illegitimacy in New York City made by Ruth Reed, she found that in 144 cases out of 410, the father was a chance acquaintance, and the mother often did not know the name, age, or address of the father of her child. In 1894 in Washington, D.C., 26.5% of live Negro births were illegitimate, and among whites, 2.6% were illegitimate. 50 years later, the rate of Negroes was 12 times that of the whites. The ratio had increased from 10 to 12. In New Orleans, in 1938, 10% of the Negro births were illegitimate, and in Natchez, Mississippi, in the same year, 33.5% of the Negro births were illegitimate. The following table from a bulletin of the Department of Commerce, Bureau of Census, 1943, gives a comparison between the Negro and white. I'm not going to read this chart, but anyhow, the census bulletin says the completeness with which the fact of illegitimacy is reported in the United States is not known. However, it is generally believed that it is significantly incomplete in some areas. Furthermore, it is possible that the under-registration is relatively greater for illegitimate births than for legitimate births. If either or both of these conditions exist, the reported illegitimacy rates are lower than the true rates. I'm going to skip through. There's several charts here to show about this illegitimacy rate among blacks. Although the Bible says, here we go again, that all men are liars, the Negro is particularly susceptible to this form of moral delinquency. Negroes are oriental in their attitude towards truth. They will tell barefaced lies in order to be agreeable. They will say yes when they mean no, so as not to offend. Negroes make poor witnesses in court. It is difficult to tell when they're lying and when they're telling the truth. I guess that is covered by the word jive. They jive the white man. A coroner in the South once told me, quote, a Negro never testifies at an inquest against the accused, the one who remains alive after the argument. The dead nigger is always the bad nigger. He explained that this lack of desire to get the truth and see justice done is based on fear. Witnesses are afraid that the murderer might wield a knife again on them. In cases involving Negroes and whites, Negroes will testify in favor of their colored brethren, like sailors who stand by the ship in maritime litigation. Negroes stand by their color, as whites should do. The general experience of white people in the South is that Negroes are apt to be petty thieves. They will steal chickens, food from the kitchen, small sums of money, and so on. This failing fits with their general weakness of character, since they cannot resist temptation. Negroes are like the inhabitants of the Ladrone Islands, who stole everything off the Magellan flagship when he landed there over 400 years ago. However, many Negroes are just as honest as white people, and the whole race cannot be said to be dishonest. Negroes are lazy and given to slothfulness. Many only work when they have to. They are indifferent workers, and for this reason, white workers have always considered themselves superior, and the objection to Negroes on account of color has often been only secondary. As a general rule, Negroes are indifferent, careless, and incompetent. This is the reason why employers of labor look with disfavor on their employment. Here is what C.A. Franklin, the editor of the Kansas City Call, a Negro newspaper, said in a recent editorial. It was a sad hour for the editor of this paper when he sat down and listened to the experiences of a merchant who had employed Negro women in his retail establishment, only to have to dismiss 9 of 10 of them for gross incompetence. Might help if I had my microphone turned around the right way. They would be inexperienced, he knew, but they would bring to the job surliness, impudence, insubordination, and a general disregard of customers he did not anticipate. The wages paid were ample. Many times what these workers had been getting in domestic employment they were accustomed to. The hours were only 8. The work was within their capacity, but 9 of 10 of them had to be dismissed. Their failure cannot be explained away. It is a disheartening situation. That was written by a black man. One of the serious deficiencies in the mental makeup of the Negro is his lack of thrift. This may be accounted for by his training and environment for thousands of years. Yet thriftfulness is so prevalent among Negroes that it almost seems inborn. Ellsworth Huntington in The Characteristics of Races, 1924, shows how early migrants to the African jungles had an advantage over those who lived in the northern forests. In the tropical forests, food was plentiful, coconuts, berries, fruit, and even insects, which were and still are an important article of food in Africa, observes Huntington. There is less likelihood of prolonged periods without food, so that the hoarding instinct and power of self-control in order to make the food last through a period of deprivation are not fostered so much as further poleward in the northern hemisphere. That thrift has become a hereditary characteristic in northern peoples, who, because of conditions, had to first struggle hard for their food, and second, like a squirrel, store it away in times of plenty for the days of scarcity. It's doubtful, as we know, that acquired characteristics are not inherited. thrift or the tradition of thrift, however, may have been so ingrained into the minds of those who were forced to employ it, we might also call it a secondary instinct. The same would apply to thriftiness. In any event, Caucasians are generally speaking thrifty and Negroes are not. Negroes do not save their money. They alone belong to the grasshopper school of thought. They enjoy life while they can. It's amazing how fast the white race seems to be degenerating into this Negro type attitude, not just by physical crossbreeding and all that, but thinking. You could be perfectly white with blonde hair and blue eyes and still be thinking like a Negro. Negro workers like to make a few days, then lay off and spend the money they've earned. Other backward peoples have a similar philosophy. In building air and naval bases in the South America, the United States government, having a fixed scale of pay, paid the native laborers the same wage as American citizens. This is three or four times what the natives had been getting. The result is that instead of working 6 days a week, they worked 2 or 3 days to earn as much money as they had been earning in 6 days. So they took 3 days off to rest and enjoy themselves. Roger Babson, in syndicated column, took Negroes to task for their lack of thrift, saying, quote, "The way you are foolishly spending money today is a shame and disgrace. Some of you foolishly refuse to work if you have a little cash in your pockets. This applies to strong men and women as well as to your young people." He said Negroes were saying, "Aunt Eleanor will take care of me after the war." Even during war times, when work was plentiful and every hour counted, absenteeism was greater among Negroes than among white people. A study made of the National Urban League in 1944 in 300 typical war plants in 25 states and 120 cities and covering 150,000 Negro workers stated that the greatest trouble arising from using Negro workers was that of absenteeism. The most frequent complaints listed by 142 plants that reported deficiency of Negro workers were, in 67 plants, high rate of absenteeism, in 51 plants, race friction, in 11 plants, chip on the shoulder attitude, and in 13 plants, high turnover. It does not take a war to emphasize this failing of the Negro worker. In the South, Monday is Blue Monday for many employers of Negro labor because the employees have not yet recovered from the weekend play. Negroes stay away from their jobs on the slightest excuse. Negroes seem to have little sense of time. Among savages, there is no record of the past. They know nothing about the calendar. And so they cannot date anything for the future. In the tropics, where there are no changes of season and one day is like another, natives pay little attention to days, months, or years. So when carried down to smaller divisions of time, the Negro is still free from the consciousness of it. If you send him on an errand, he does not go directly and quickly, but will linger along the wayside. If a Negro makes an appointment, he is seldom prompt. Sometimes he will not show up at all. The flight of time seems to make no impression on him. John Dollard in Caste and Class says, "I noticed that low-class Negroes were less reliable on the score of time. Frequently they would miss appointments and present the weakest of excuses when they came back. Some simply solved the dilemma by not coming back at all. superstition is still rife among Negroes, and then, of course, boy, they gravitate to these churches like you can't believe. John Dullard, in Caste and Class in a Southern Town, says that the middle-class Negroes believe in dreams and superstitions of all kinds. He does not mention the educated class, but certain it is the lower class is very superstitious. N.N. Puckett has written an interesting book on the subject, Folk Belief of the Southern Negro, Chapel Hill, 1926. After a study of Negro superstitions, he concludes, these cases, which could be multiplied indefinitely, show clearly the grip of superstition upon Southern Negroes. Conjuration is constantly having a hand in the practical affairs of life. In the city of New Orleans, where slaves were often imported directly from Africa, there is a square which used to be known as Congo Square. In the old days, on Sundays, Negro slaves would be allowed to go to the square where native dances were held and African cult rites practiced. About these last, there was more or less secrecy, but in this manner the ideas and superstitions of voodoo cult were preserved. Years ago in New Orleans, there was a celebrated voodoo queen called Maria Laveau, and there's a song about that. I've sung that song. If you go down in the swamp, you've got to watch out for Maria Laveau, whose fame as a protector against evil influences and a promoter of evil was widespread. For certain sums of money, she would ward off evil from a worried client, or for another who sought to overcome an enemy, she would invoke the powers of evil. Many Negroes are still fearful of spells and voodoo. They are also great believers in love potions that will win the love of an unresponsive dusky dame or overcome the success of a hated rival. The old beliefs in witchcraft and magic are prevalent. The Negro, as were his ancestors in Africa for thousands of years, is harassed by the fear of evil spirits. He is likewise afraid of hants or ghosts, and it is this fear that enabled the Ku Klux Klan of Reconstruction days to scare thousands of these simple people when members of the Klan appeared in their ghostly array. As a result of the Negro's failings, although he is apt to assign the reason to other causes, such as prejudice or lack of opportunity, Negroes in the United States live in comparative poverty. According to a table in the American Dilemma, the following is the median income for Negroes compared to whites. And it so shows a graph here in New York. Negro families made $980, and white families $1,930. And it goes even down south, South Carolina, $576 for the Negro, $876 for the white. Although the total property owned by Negroes in the United States is now substantial and amounts to over $2 billion, it is small when compared to the total wealth of the United States, which is about $350 billion. Of course, now they've got a lot of these sports people and rock and rollers and rap music people that have got tremendous amounts of money. Generally speaking, the standard of living of the Negro is the lowest of any group in the United States, and over 90% belong to the lowest income group. The economic situation of the Negro in America is pathological, except for a small minority enjoying upper or middle class. I will say that in my studies, under segregation, there were a lot of black millionaires when they were separate. And the first Negro female millionaire in the United States was a black woman who came up with the process to straighten kinky Negro hair. She was from St. Louis. The masses of the American Negroes in the rural South and in the segregated slum quarters in southern and northern cities are destitute. They own little property, even their household goods are almost inadequate and dilapidated. Now you see, Donald Trump's going to change all this. And you know he can't change all that because of the nature of the brood. He's going to bring wealth to the ghetto. Well, good luck, Donald, because you're going to have to take that money from white workers and give it to these holes in the ground called ghettos, where it'll all be wasted. I mean, look at the billions of dollars they've spent since the Civil Rights Program into the black communities, and they're still not any better than they were before. But they deny it. Of course, it's because of the race. It's because of the white man robs them. You know? And in some cases, that's true. I'm not saying it's not. It is a well-known fact that the Negro contributes more than his share to our prison population. Well, it's even worse. However, I don't believe in this incarcerating people for long periods of time because of drugs. I don't believe it. He also is more often guilty of misdemeanors and petty larcenies. The following table shows the prisoners received from the courts 1940. The proportion of Negroes in the 15 southern states convicted and sentenced for murder and aggravated assault is more than twice the proportion of whites. Negroes show larger proportions for manslaughter and burglary, while whites show larger proportions for robbery and auto theft. Whites sentenced for forgery and embezzlement are three times that of Negroes. Negroes served longer periods of imprisonment than did whites in all sections of the country. A large proportion of crimes of passion among Negroes is due to the violent and aggressive behavior shown more often by lower class blacks. Lower class Negroes fight more, and these fights are due to their free sexual life, jealousy, and gambling disputes, and of course now drugs. 11 Negroes are killed violently for every white who dies a violent death, according to the New Orleans item. By their crimes you may know them. Whites and Negroes have their own specific types of crime. For instance, police list more arrests for drunkenness and vagrancy among white persons than among Negroes, but list more homicides, robberies, assaults, burglaries, larcenies, and prostitution among Negroes. That's why if you insist that there's equality of the races, you're always going to lose. And it's a form where whites are lying to themselves to hide their own racism by continually pushing this idea that the races are equal or any individual is equal. The scars received by Negroes in cutting a phrase are a mark of honor, much as the German student are proud of their dueling scars, and a prison record brought about by cutting or shooting makes a Negro respected by his friends. These observations apply, however, only to the lower class Negroes, since educated Negroes are generally law-abiding. The Committee on Crime and Delinquency in Harlem reported that the arrests for prostitution in New York City, 54% were Negro women, and the rate was 10 times greater for them than the white women. Let me point out, I watched a movie last night. It was called Hoodlum, and it took place in Harlem. And it was a pretty accurate depiction of what was going on, because you had the white guys running the drugs and the numbers game downtown. That, I always get confused in New York. They call, you know, the better district, they call it downtown. I was always the practice of calling any town downtown the worst part of town. Anyhow, and the blacks, they had this gal called Queenie. She was running all the numbers rackets in Harlem. But these Jew guys, let's see, who was it? Dutch Schultz, who was a Jew. His name was Arthur Flegenheimer, but he didn't like that name. And also Lucky Luciano, which, of course, was a mob guy, and he was one of the top guys. He's in the movie, he was actually more reasonable. Than Dutch Schultz was a real heavy-handed kind of guy, according to the movie. So they had really knocked down, drag out wars, and at one point, the black guy, who was the so-called hero of the movie, he goes downtown, that was the white part of town, and takes a big truck and runs it into the distillery and the warehouses of Dutch Schultz and blows the damn warehouse sky high as payback. Anyhow, a very violent movie, but I think it's pretty accurate, called Hoodlum. Okay. According to the Uniform Crime Reports of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for 1940, the arrests per 100,000 population were 1,078.4 for Negroes and 391.6 for whites. In every offense, the Negro rate was higher than that of whites except for forgery and counterfeiting. For homicides and assaults, the Negro rate was 136.2 per 100,000, and for the whites, 18.9%. Although in the United States during the decade from 31 to 1940, inclusively, the curve of prison commitments was downward. In the last 3 or 4 years, crime is on the increase, particularly among Negroes. Leon Lewis, Negro Executive Secretary of the New Orleans Negro Press Club, in a talk before members of his club, is quoted in the New Orleans Item of October 23, 1942, as having deplored the increased crime wave among Negroes. Lewis stated that from 1929 to 1939, in New Orleans, a total of 844 Negroes were killed by members of their own race, and that burglary and theft was increasing among the Negroes. Dr. A. E. Perkins, a well-known New Orleans Negro educator, said in the item of the same date, quote, inadequate home control and direction is responsible for much Negro crime. Then, too, the Negro has not yet learned the full meaning of self-control or self-advancement and progress. He hasn't learnt the full meaning of application to duty and sees an opportunity for idleness. A committee study crime in Richmond, Virginia, reported in 43 in Richmond last year, out of 44 slayings, 36 were confined to killings of Negroes by Negroes. 5 involved killings of whites, and only 3 involved members of the two races. You see, that's the big lie. You know, all this crime is primarily Negro against Negro. You know that, I know that, but nobody wants to really talk about it very much. And the minute you open your mouth, they say, oh, you're a racist. Yeah, well, I am, of course. Richmond's high percentage of Negro homicides is by no means out of line with other cities such as Atlanta, Baltimore, Birmingham, Charlotte, Louisiana, or Louisville, Memphis, and Tampa, in some of which the ratio runs much greater than it does in this city. The FBI figures show that the Virginia Capitol's homicide rate jumped from 16.58 per 100,000 in 41 to 22.79 in 42. Other southern cities with higher percentages were Norfolk, with 20.83 and 30.69, and Charlotte, North Carolina with 21.78 and 30.69. However, it is not only in the South that the Negroes lead in law violations. In Brooklyn, conditions got so bad that the grand jury report charged that there were widespread crime and hoodlumism. There are over 100,000 Negroes in Bedford section. An effort was made by the city authorities to check on conditions there, but the police could get little cooperation from the population. As usual, the crime wave in Bedford section of Brooklyn was said to be caused by housing conditions. And I wonder if those were some of the apartment buildings that Trump's dad owned. In sentencing Negro hoodlums, one judge blamed cheap dance halls and pool halls. A social worker in the Bedford district complains that the policemen were afraid to treat Negro hoodlums rough. If they did, it might provoke race riots with political repercussions. She said that there are 110,000 Negroes living in this community, and no one seems to know anything about them or their needs. Average Negroes have told me that, in their opinion, much good would be done if the police would handle Negro hoodlums in the way they do white hoodlums. These people feel that the police here should be more firm and exercise their police functions. Well, the same thing holds true today. Well, that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. Let's see. Wait a minute. This is Friday. Oh, I forgot her. Well, I'll have to get a song out here for the girls or for the she-wolves to close out. I hope you find this interesting, but nothing's changed except it's gotten worse. There's far more poor Negroes than ever. Far more rich Negroes than ever, and far more middle-class Negroes as ever, but not so much. So the reason for the rejection of the Negro primarily is they don't want Negroes moving into the neighborhoods, or at least they used to not. I think they still feel that way today, is because they bring their lifestyle into the white neighborhoods. Very simple. And that's why they want to keep them in their ghetto.
There's a new sheriff in town.
What I'm about to do for you is an old ballad that I recorded many years back. It's been one of my favorites since I recorded it. I hope that you folks might still remember it and that you might still like it. Now and then there's a fool such as I am.
somehow. Something in your kiss just told me my sometime is now. Everybody finds somebody someplace. There's no telling where love may appear. Something in my heart keeps saying my someplace is here. If I had it in my power, I'd arrange for every girl to have your charm. Then every minute, every hour, every boy would find what I've found in your heart. Everybody loves somebody sometime. And although my dream was overdue, your love made it well worth waiting for someone like you.
If I had been my power,
I would arrange for every girl to have your charm. Every boy would find what I found in your heart. Everybody loves somebody sometime. And although my dream was overdue, your love made it well worth waiting for someone.
And that's the song for the She-Wolves out there on Friday.